Again to the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Thursday, April 11th, 2013, and this is podcast number 300. The arrow has been used as a measuring device, a symbol of property, a standard of law, and a tool of justice. So today in the podcast, I ask, is law a standard or a whim? Hope you enjoy this classic from podcast number 203. Now, the question I want to ask today, actually I have two questions. One is, what is law? And is law a standard, or is it just a whim? And I want to address that and really kind of explore it a little bit today. In theory, law is a measuring device. If you think of think of different measuring devices, like a yardstick or a meter stick. A master carpenter, you know, back in the olden days when I was young, master carpenters would always carry a folding ruler. It goes by different names. Some people call it a Tom Stoke, Some people call it a Tom Stokes rule. I think that's a mistranslation of a Norwegian or some Scandinavian name for it, because I think they call it a Tom Stoke, which is translated as a thumb stick, but Google didn't help me much on that. I tried to look up Tom Stokes rule and Tom Stoke, and Google was of no use to me whatsoever. But so maybe maybe that's just because I'm old and people in the olden days used to call it a Tom Stokes rule. But I'm pretty sure it comes from the Scandinavian word that means thumb stick, not Tom Stoke. But anyway, but I'm not sure on that. I could be wrong on that. But one way or the other, law is a measuring device. And if you think of a yardstick or a ruler, a rule or a ruler, it is a thing that you use to compare one thing to another to see if it is what it's supposed to be, if it measures up to what it's supposed to be. So now, one theory on the birth of the state, and I don't necessarily hold to this theory, but I can see where it has some valid aspects to it. But one theory on the birth of the state has to do with a master mason who possessed a standard measuring device or a ruler. And now, this could have just been a local, you know, I've talked before about the birth of the state in Jericho and how the myth of Tammuz, the god, the shepherd god, who was originally a shepherd god, and then he became a god of bread eventually, and then he gave legitimacy to the criminals who had fortified themselves in Jericho. But this other story of the origin of the state might have some truth in it too, as far as someone having particular carpentry skills or masonry skills, and utilizing the rule, the measurement of what is good and what is bad, tying that somehow mystically to the criminals that ran the state. So you could kind of see that in a place like Egypt, where construction was of a very precise nature, and where the whole society really wrapped around the importance of having a properly standardized measurement of. They used the cubit in most of the desert regions, used one version or another of the cubit. The cubit being essentially the distance from the back of the elbow to the tip of the middle finger. And so that was the standard rule in a lot of the desert communities where the state was being birthed throughout what we now call the Middle East. So you can kind of see where Egyptian rulers, literally Egyptian rulers, could have had their base in whoever the master carpenter or master mason who possessed this almost magical knowledge to be able to construct with the precision that they did. And eventually, of course, it was the king's. It was a measurement of the king's elbow to the tip of the king's fingertip that became the standard cubit for Egypt. Now, forest people were a little different on this. You know, if you live in the desert and you don't have a whole lot of choices about what you're going to build permanent construction out of, so it ends up being stone. But if you're a forest people, if you live, say, in northern Europe or across parts of Asia, Southeast Asia, South America, if you're a forest-dwelling people and not a desert-dwelling people, then you're not forced to use stone as your standard building material. You have the luxury of wood. So with forest-based people, the cubit was not the standard. The yard became the standard. And the yard has two interesting aspects to it. The yard is basically the length of one man's stride, but it's also the length of an arrow. Now, it could have originated from either of these two. Most likely, though, the distance of a yard came first from the arrow, and it was only because it was a coincidence that it was the same length as a step. But the length of a step is about the length that you can fully pull back a longbow in a comfortable fashion and still have enough of the arrow protruding from the end of the from the longbow to hold in its place properly before you shoot it. So literally a stride and the length of an arrow for a longbow would have been the same thing, and it could have even been that coincidence, or it's not really coincidence, it's designed of the human body, but it could have been that coincidence of commonness linked the two, and so here's two different ways you can measure and come up with the same distance. It's either the length of an arrow or the length of a stride. So one way or the other, places like Northern Europe tended to use the yard as a measurement, whereas places like, you know, the desert areas that where trees were not in the same level of abundance tended to use the length of a man's elbow to his tip of his middle finger. And that's why I think it had more to do with the arrow than just the stride by itself. In the desert areas, there were bows and arrows existed among the desert people, but it was much more common for the bow and arrow to be replaced in desert areas by the sling, the rock and the sling. Both were very effective weapons, and both were very effective for hunting. But in a desert setting, it's much more difficult to come up with the quality of wood that it takes to build a really good bow and arrow. So deep in the recesses of history, way back in the back, when things were first getting going, the arrow. If you can imagine in your mind the leap of technology, well, let's go this way. Okay, so the very, very first tool that man would encounter and man would begin to utilize was the hammer. Basically, it's you pick up a rock and you hit something with the rock. And phase two of using the hammer is to throw the hammer. You can throw the rock, so to speak. And now the very next stage of tool building was either the lever or the blade. It was most likely the blade, the lever being the handle on that hammer. But more likely it was the blade, because the blade is simply a sharpened hammer. So the first tool that mankind developed was the hammer. The second tool, in all likelihood, was the blade. And the third tool was the lever, the handle of the blade or the handle of the hammer. And then, of course, the lever has a tremendous application in every direction, including, if you really think about it, a wheel is nothing more than a series of levers. That's really all a wheel is. If you imagine the center of a wheel and the spokes going outward, what you really just have as the wheel turns is a series of levers, one following the other. So we have the hammer, the blade, the lever, and then eventually fire. And but at some point in time, and probably, you know, who knows at exactly what point, someone figured out that wood, the lever, can be used in a different way. Wood has a certain flexing characteristics, and some types of wood are better than other types of wood. And the storing of energy within the flex of this wood could be utilized to sling an arrow. And once this took place, the technological leap of just being forced to throw a spear, to having this machine that could shoot an arrow, that leap was a tremendous technological advance. And as you think about that, you begin to understand why ancient man actually attributed the arrow as having magical characteristics. The arrow seemed, you know, it was a tool like no other tool that had ever been invented. And the arrow, if you ever watch an arrow in flight as it arcs across and then strikes its target with accuracy, it's an amazing thing. So you can kind of see how the arrow took on magical qualities, and you can see how the arrow could then, since it's a standard length, pretty much, since a bow is a standard length, you need a bow about the height of a man, and the length of an arrow has to be pretty standardized, and it just so happens that the length of an arrow is the same as the stride of a man. So all these coincidences work together, again, to enhance the magical characteristics of the arrow. So now you've got this arrow, so now it's a measuring device. You can use the arrow to measure in a number of different ways. The theory on how we developed the idea of an acre is that how much land can be plowed by a single man with a single oxen in a single day. But there's some flaws to that. The flaw is that long before a man could domesticate an ox and convince the ox to work a hard day pulling a plow, and before men ever developed a plow, he had the arrow. And the funny thing about an arrow and an acre is, if you stand in one spot with a longbow and an arrow, and if you fire that arrow, you need more than one arrow. Let's say you have a quiver full of arrows, and you stand there and you fire that arrow in each direction, and just kind of slowly turn a circle and fire that arrow in every direction with a longbow. That's about an acre. You have just circled an acre around you of land, which happens to be about how much land that an oxen and a man can plow in a day. So then what we actually are looking at here is an acre of land is a measurement of land that can be worked and developed by a single man and protected by a single man. You see, this is really the two aspects of private property. One is that you can utilize it. There's other aspects of private property as well, but these two are primary. The fact that you can utilize this property and you can defend this property. Now the third thing is that there has to be some scarcity to it. So all property can be described as having these three characteristics. There has to be a scarcity of it. You need to be able to utilize it, and you need to be able to defend it. Now technically you can say property is anything that there is a scarcity of. But owned property takes on this new characteristic, and this is kind of what, in a different way of saying it, this is kind of what Adam Smith was talking about when he was referring to working property and homesteading it and making it your own. So when we think about property, and you think about the characteristics of the property, and then the arrow ties directly to it, an arrow becomes a way to measure your property, a way to defend your property, and here's the last thing an arrow does, it's a way to claim your property. Because here in antiquity, one way that you could tell if you're just walking along through the forest or you're walking along across the meadow or whatever like this, and you found an arrow just stuck in the ground or perhaps symbolically stuck into something and mounted for a person to see, then what that was telling you was that you're entering private property and you had better announce yourself or turn around and go back the other way, because you risk getting one of those arrows plopped into your shoulder. So the arrow was actually used to mark territory and used to defend territory and used to signify property and property rights. Now, when I get back from the break, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, and I'll try to link it to the idea of law. Stick with me. I'll be right back. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. So now there's another thing about the arrow that that we know. The arrow is one of the oldest known symbols for private property. If you go into archaeology and so forth like this, there have been old arrows that have been found that had specific markings on them that indicated private property. And if you take it all the way back into a hunter-gatherer setting, the arrow, if you're out hunting with a bow and arrow, and you fire your arrow, and if you're hunting properly, then what's going to happen is you strike the animal, and if you get a good shot, if you're good at what you're doing and you do what you're supposed to do, what you want to do is you want to plant that arrow into the lung of the animal. The heart is just too small to try to hit and too deep inside the body cavity. But hitting it anywhere else in a muscle is not going to do you any good. It's just going to run away with your arrow. But if you can hit, and a head shot is just not something you want to do with a bow and arrow. It's just going to bounce off the animal's skull in all likelihood, and all you're going to do is irritate him, and now you don't have your arrow. So what you really want to do is you want to take a lung shot. You want to catch the animal in the lung with your arrow, and if possible, if you can hit in a position to hit both lungs, then that's even better. But that's kind of hard to do with an arrow. In all likelihood, you're going to take out one lung, and then you're going to follow the trail of blood that this animal is going to leave behind, and it's going to huff and puff, and it's going to basically slowly bleed to death and drown in its own blood as it tries to get away from you. And so you follow this trail of blood, and you eventually find your animal. Now, when you do, your arrow is still going to be in that animal. And so this is a symbol of property rights. If somebody else finds your animal with your arrow stuck in it, then they have to do two things. First off, they have to give a reasonable amount of time to allow you to find your arrow and your animal. And they have to acknowledge that it is your animal when you get there. And if they've waited a reasonable amount of time and you haven't shown up, and obviously you've lost the trail of the animal, then they can go ahead and harvest the animal, but they have to keep your arrow, and if you show up, they have to give you back your arrow and pay you the compensation for the animal that you lost. Now, they don't have to give you all the animal, of course, because, you had essentially lost the animal, but still, the arrow held this indication of property rights. Long before somebody wanted a farm and wanted an acre of land and wanted to be able to defend it. So it was logical enough once the hunter-gatherer became the farmer, that he would still maintain his archery abilities, because you'd still want to, add wild game to your diet, even if you're a farmer. And also, the arrow was an easy way, not really easy, but it was the easiest way of the day to learn a skill that was very handy. You could defend yourself, you could defend your family, you could defend at a distance, not only from humans, but from animals as well, which it's much better to fight an enemy at a distance than it is up close. So again, the arrow had almost magical characteristics. So as you look into antiquity, the arrow became associated with property. And if you think about it, what is law? Well, law is the measurement of what's good and right in direct relationship with property. All proper law, all good law, is a measurement of what is right and what is wrong in regards to property. That's the original source of what law is. Now, that's not what it is today. That's not what the government has twisted it into. But as it developed and as the ideas and the thoughts developed, law was that measuring device to say, has someone's property been aggressed against? Is there an aggression? If so, who is at fault? And the law was the measuring device that determined these things. So since the arrow had this almost magical characteristic, this mystical characteristic that I talked about, and since the arrow was one of, if not the oldest actual indication of property rights, the arrow was the obvious thing to use as a symbol for law, because considering law was a measuring device to measure what's good and right, and an arrow was a standardized measuring device. It was a yard long. If you weren't sure how long something was, you could just lay your arrow down onto it, count how many arrows long it is. Now you know how long it is. So the arrow was a measuring device, just like law, and the arrow was related to property, just like law. So the arrow became a symbol of law, especially among woodlands people, not so much, like I was saying, not so much in desert people, because they utilized the sling more than the arrow. So then, and the arrow, again, being the distance that you can shoot an arrow in all around you, if you shot in every direction from where you're standing, that's roughly 1 acre of land. So again, it's a measurement that you could use. Now, another thing to keep in mind about an arrow is, once you let the arrow fly, once the arrow is loosened from its bounds and it flies through the air, the arrow doesn't discriminate. Once it's in flight, it strikes the king the same way as it strikes the farmer or the thief. The arrow doesn't have any. It's not a respecter of persons. The arrow brings justice without caring who it strikes. It follows a straight, uninterrupted path, and it strikes exactly where it's supposed to strike. Where it follows the exact trajectory. It's true, and so it's a true measurement of distance, and it's true in its flight, and it's not a respecter of men. So it will strike the king or the thief the same as the farmer. Now, so the arrow had the ability to mark distances. The arrow also had the ability to record messages. It had the ability to prove ownership, and it had the ability to strike down tyrants or thieves. So we see why it was magic. When I was referring to its ability to record messages, what people would actually do is you could take an arrow, and first off, it's already marked with the symbols of its owner, so it's like a signature. You know who it came from. And then the next thing you could do with the arrow is you could tie a cord on the arrow, and with a series of knots, you could actually give a message, and then you hand the arrow to your messenger, and he would foot run it to whoever it was that you wanted to give the message to, and then they would count the knots on the cord, and that would be, it was kind of almost like a Morse code type thing. You could send a basic message like that, and the arrow was the signature of who the message was coming from. So again, this arrow, you can see how the arrow took on these magical capabilities. Now, oftentimes in antiquity, oftentimes the measuring device, whether that be an arrow or whether it was the size, whether it was a cubit was oftentimes a reed or some other type of like a piece of wood or something would be used. And almost like a small staff, and it would be cut in the perfect size of the cubit and marked with some type of seal, guaranteeing that it was accurate. And that was used by the carpenter or by the mason or whatever as the standard, just like we use a rule stick today. That's what the in desert communities, that's how the cubit was used. So oftentimes these measuring devices, whether we're talking about the arrow or the cubit, would be held. The judge would hold this in his hand as he was hearing, as he was acting as an arbitrator between two parties that had a conflict. And of course, what is a legitimate conflict about? It's always about property and aggression. Someone's property and someone has aggressed upon that property. So all arbitration, all legitimate arbitration, is based on property and aggression. So again, we've got this arrow as the symbol of being of bringing truth and bringing a measurement to this question of arbitration, to find out what is the truth and to measure what justice needs to be. So the arrow was a symbolic measuring device, but literally it was the rule of law. It also represented property, since all rightful conflict is a question of property and aggression. But the arrow also symbolized justice, because all parties involved and the witnesses understood that if the arbitrator didn't find justice, ultimately the arrow would. You see the trick there? Now, again, not only did the two conflicting parties understand this, but the arbitrator understood it. If you have a corrupt arbitrator, he's standing there holding the arrow. This arrow is speaking to him as well, saying, if you don't judge this correctly, this arrow might come flying back at you. So it was a symbol to all the parties involved that you had to respect the justice and the law, the measurement of the law. Now, at times, the actual tip and the feather part were taken off of the arrow, and it was there strictly symbolically as a staff. So oftentimes, especially with time, the actual carrying of an arrow as the symbol of a person, or carrying a message, or the judge holding the arrow, the actual tip and the feathers were not necessary for the purpose, so they were left off. And so it was just strictly the measuring device, but it had its origins in that arrow. In pre-Christian Northern Europe, the arbitration itself would often take place under a sacred tree, not in a royal court. The idea of using a royal court was more of a Southern European, Mediterranean, and desert community, where they were, you know, where they were more likely to be under the thumb of a king, of a ruler of some kind. But in Northern Europe, this arbitration would take place under a sacred tree. Now, that's significant because when the Christians came in and brought the state with them into Northern Europe, one of the things that they did was to kill all the arbitrators and burn the sacred trees, because they had to break this tie with the past and with the way law used to be found and the way justice used to be determined. They had to break the tie with it, and they had to convince the people that the state, basically, either through the church itself or through the church's puppet kings, the state was the ultimate arbitrator, and the state determined what law was. That was what came. Unfortunately, that's not really Christian in its origin, but that's what came into Northern Europe with the encroachment of the church. Eventually, you know, in pre-Christian Europe, the king was not appointed by God. In European paganism, European paganism was very individual. It was not like, you know, the mythology of Egypt or you know, the Greeks or Romans or the Persians. It wasn't like their theologies with hierarchies. Northern European paganism was very individualistic. So the king was not appointed by God to the Northern Europeans. The king didn't possess any magical powers and so forth. Usually he wasn't really a king. He was some type of a recognized clan leader, but he was not a king in the sense that Southern Europeans recognized that. So that really didn't come in until Christianity came in and brought that Southern European concept of a king with it. Again, so that's why when the Southern Europeans moved northward with their Christianity, they had to kill all the clan leaders and burn the sacred trees. So eventually, throughout Europe, the king became the symbol of law. The king became the measurement. His body in inches and feet and things like this, inches based on the king's thumb and feet based on his feet and this kind of a thing. And the arrow was dropped as the standard measurement. In Northern Europe, the king never really took on the level of almost godly position like it was in other parts of Europe. If you think about somebody like Richard the Lionhearted, he was in the process of trying to tax one of his landowners when the landowner put a bolt through, an arrow through his shoulder, and eventually the gangrene set in and killed him. So again, when the king is the one that's aggressing, the arrow doesn't really care who it is. The arrow strikes. Now in Egypt, you can see the government as the arbitrator with the encroachment of the state into Northern Europe. But in Egypt, the pharaoh, now we're stepping backwards, a couple thousand years. The pharaoh was essentially the government. He was the state. I won't get into the distinction between state and government into this because I've done that so many other times. But in ancient Egypt, the pharaoh, as the head of state, was the ultimate arbitrator of all situations. Now, if you look in in art and in carvings and things like that, in Egypt, the pharaoh is often shown holding a whip and a shepherd's cane. Now, even though the cubits were also used, according to different ceremonies and in judging and things like that, the images always show the pharaoh with the whip and the shepherd's cane, because they want to emphasize, it's really just propaganda, they want to emphasize that the state is dominating the people, so they always would show the pharaoh holding both the whip and the shepherd's cane. But again, if you continue to look in Egypt through the images and through artifacts that have been found, there's always a cubit with the pharaoh as well. It's right there in his burial stuff. There's a ceremonial cubit there because it was very, very important. So once the government becomes the arbitrator in all legal matters, you begin to lose the repercussions for bad laws and bad judgments. Once, especially in the case with Egypt, where the head of state is divinely positioned, there's a connection between the gods and the king, or the gods and the pharaoh, or whatever. When you have this divinely appointed individual as the head of state, then the next step, of course, is for the state to become the origin of law and the arbitrator of all things, of all conflicts. And that removes, because the king is divinely appointed, that removes any repercussions for having bad laws or bad judgments. Because how can the king be wrong if he's appointed by God? How can the king make a bad decision if he is the voice of God? So government itself, once it encroached upon law, and once it usurped the ability of true justice, and it began replacing justice with its own version, the repercussion for bad laws and for bad judgment disappeared. Because, as Hans Hermann Hoppe has pointed out, government seeks to be the ultimate arbitrator in every conflict, including conflicts with the government itself. And this conflict of interest creates a situation where the government is incapable of actually producing justice on any level. It can't produce laws, because all laws are going to be twisted by this conflict of interest. And it can't rightfully inflict any laws on anyone because of this conflict of interest. Now, when I get back, I'm going to try to wrap this up and make some sense out of it for you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. So now government begins to be, it tends to take over the arbitration process, and government begins to take over the creation of law. And the result of that is that government tends to create conflict in order to justify its own existence. In other words, if you're sitting around saying, well, what do we need government for? Well, then the government's answer is, well, you have to have government to keep you people from fighting with each other. Because without government as an arbitrator, you know, every conflict will turn into violence. So this is one of the arguments that's made. This is Hobbes' classic argument, actually. But this is not true. Humans tend to figure out arbitration much better when there is no government, when there is voluntary arbitration, and third parties, under voluntary arbitration, third parties won't have that conflict of interest. So actually, government interferes with the proper arbitration of conflict. And like I said, government tends to, because it needs to justify its own existence, it tends to create conflicts just for the purpose of justifying itself. It'll twist laws in order to make conflicts where conflicts never existed before. Think about all the people that are jailed in America. Think about the jails filled with people. More Americans are jailed than Chinese, and that's considering that there's, you know, the population in the U.S. is tiny compared to China. And China, most people think China is a horribly oppressive government, right? Well, clearly, by sheer math, you can see that the American government is far more oppressive than the Chinese government, because a far greater amount of people, not just proportion to the population, but just sheer numbers, far more people are imprisoned in the United States than are imprisoned in China, or than were imprisoned in the Soviet Union back in the old Soviet Union days. More Americans are in prison. And why are they in prison? Was there some kind of violent conflict that got them thrown in jail? No. Almost all of them are in prison because of conflicts that did not involve violence. How can there possibly be a conflict then that the state would need to get involved in and put somebody in prison for? If there's no aggression, how can a person justify putting another person in prison? And yet, in the vast majority of cases in the United States, people are in prison not because of aggression, not because of a physical conflict with someone, but it's for possessing a certain property. The vast majority of people in the United States who are in prison are there on some type of drug-related charges. So we're talking about possessing property. They're in jail for possessing property. Now think about this. So who did they aggress against? Whose property was it? Somebody had to own the property in order for them to aggress upon it, right? Well, no. The government has just arbitrarily decided that certain property you're not allowed to own. But yet, here's the funny part. The laws that originally, let's say with marijuana, the original marijuana laws didn't outlaw the substance at all, or didn't outlaw the possession. It just made it mandatory that you have a stamp that proved that the government was okay with you possessing it. In other words, the government was saying by that the government owned the property, but it was authorizing you to possess it at least for a period of time. You see, it is about possession of property. It is about property, and it is about aggression. Because what the government is saying, when they arrest a person for a nonviolent crime, they arrest a person for possessing property, what they're really saying is that the government owns the property, and you are the aggressor for trying to own the property or for trying to possess the property without the government's permission. That's really what this is about. So even that, even the filled jails in America are filled over the conflict between property and aggression. It's just that the government has decided on its own that it's going to choose what property you can and can't own, and it's going to choose how you can and can't use that property, and when and where you can and can't use that property, and is willing to throw you in jail for long terms because of that. So once again, the government has created conflict where there didn't need to be any conflict in order to justify itself. This causes a general loss of respect for the law, because people see that essentially government has a monopoly on law. And you see that law is really just the whim of of people in government. Law has no substance. Law has no measuring device. Law is not set to anything. Law is just based on the whims of men. Law has lost its standard. It's lost its arrow. It's lost its bite. It's no longer based on anything solid. It's just based on the whims of the rulers, on what the rulers want to say. So it's lost its ability to measure anything. And so people lose respect for the law. And when people lose respect for the law, they tend to become lawless in other ways, in every way. When generations grow up seeing law as nothing more than the whim of the powerful, then power becomes law. Domination becomes desirable. And theft becomes justified, because that's all the government does. The government dominates, steals. That's all they do. They use their power, and they dominate, and they steal. So as generations grow up understanding that this is what law is simply whoever's the strongest and how much can we steal. That's what law becomes. And government becomes the teacher, teaching a generation after generation that that's what law is. Now, Bob Murphy, the other day when I had Bob Murphy on the show, he mentioned that legalizing pot would become a political move at some point in the future. And I thought that was genius what he said. He pointed it out in a way that I hadn't really thought of it before. Now, if I was beating up Gary Johnson the other day, and so I'll take a swipe at him. If you look at what Gary Johnson says needs to be done about marijuana, he says you need to legalize it, regulate it, and tax it. Legalize it, regulate it, and tax it. Does that sound like a libertarian? Gary Johnson is the libertarian nominee for the president of the United States. And he says, here's property, a substance, property. And property should be legalized, regulated, and taxed. Does that sound like a libertarian to you? Now, here's the problem with what Bob Murphy was talking about. And I don't have a problem theoretically with what he was saying. I think what he said was brilliant. But when the moment comes that the state that the government decides that it's time to legalize marijuana, they can't justify holding all these people in jails for something that's not necessarily a crime anymore. So they're going to dump essentially an army of angry criminals onto the streets in America. And of course, then we have a need for what? For a police state to keep us all safe from all those people who used to be in the prisons. See? Keep this in mind. You know, a lot of people say, oh, there's a big movement within the liberty movement that says, don't take a plea. Don't plea bargain. Don't take a plea. But plea bargains work in two different ways. First off, the innocent can be intimidated to take a plea, either because they're afraid, it's a scary situation, or because they're poor and they can't afford a long legal battle to defend themselves. So innocent people will plea, will take a plea bargain and actually be punished by the government knowing that they're innocent. Many times the prosecutor knows they're innocent. It's all beside the point. The prosecutor gets brownie points either way. But the other side of the plea bargain is that oftentimes the guilty get to plea because cops are just basically horrible investigators, prosecutors are corrupt, and judges are lazy. So because cops are horrible investigators, prosecutors are corrupt, and judges are lazy, very often real criminals, actual guilty, violent criminals, get to take lesser pleas. And what do they plea? It's some kind of a drug possession charge. So you actually have situations where violent criminals, thieves, thugs, people who have harmed people, will accept a felony conviction on drugs rather than a felony conviction of assault with intent to kill or something like that. Prosecutors make these kinds of deals because, you know, it's just easier. And there are a variety of reasons. I'll try to get William Anderson on the podcast one of these days and have him talk about this topic. But so now, what do we have here that we're looking at? We have innocent going to jail and becoming hardened. And we have prisoners inside those jails becoming more and more angry by the moment, especially the ones who were put there unjustly. And the other thing, when you're in jail for a long period of time, you become less accustomed to actual work. This, in a normal setting, this work-eat cause and effect thing, where we know that if we work, we can eat. That cause and effect is broken if you spend a lot of time in prison just sitting there, you know, maybe exercising or maybe doing some kind of menial job around the prison for extra money. But mostly what you're not doing is you're not reinforcing this work to eat cause and effect thing that's natural to humans. So when you take these people and you have them in prison for a long period of time and then you dump them back on society, then you've interfered with that work, eat, cause, effect cycle. So you've got angry people that have had their job prospects are limited and their work ethic has been harmed. So how are we going to find a solution for crime by continuing this cycle? Why is it that we have so many criminals anyway? Well, you have to look for the cause. Don't look at the effect. You have to look at the cause. The government makes criminals where there were none to begin with. And then the government doesn't address the problem of real criminals. Yeah, you take somebody who's a real criminal, a person who aggresses a thief, a robber of some kind, and you take them and you throw them in jail for 4 years or 6 years or 8 years, and then you let them back go again. What did you do? Other than, you know, feed them, other than charge taxpayers to keep them healthy, what did you actually accomplish? You didn't accomplish anything. You certainly didn't repair the damage to the person who was robbed. All you did was make this person angrier and let them have a chance to build their body and be stronger and be more muscular and feed them during that whole time. So the solution to violent criminals is not just throwing them into jail and detaining them for a time frame and then turning them back loose. And certainly throwing people into jail who are only guilty of possessing property, that's not a legitimate function of government, certainly, although it's a common function of government. So what do we have here? We have a situation where government cannot possibly produce justice, and yet government has a monopoly on the arbitration process, even in cases where the conflict is between us and the government. The government is still the ultimate arbitrator in every case. Now, so when we start thinking about these problems and we start to see these problems, the statists of the world only offer us two solutions. They say, what you need, you see, yeah, government's failing. We'll admit that. Government's failing. So what you need is more government, right? That's what we hear from the Occupy Wall Street people. Is it with government's failing, so what we need is more government. Regulations weren't enough. We need more regulations. That kind of backwards thinking like that. The only other solution that statists offer to us is let different statists be in charge of government. Like, oh, those clowns over there are messing it up, but hire me. I'll be good. The Democrats are messing everything up. Let's get a Republican in there. The Republicans are messing everything up. Let's get a Libertarian in there. The Libertarians are crazy. They want to legalize drugs. We gotta get tough on crime Republican in here. The Democrats have messed everything up. We gotta get a Republican. The Republicans have messed everything up. It's a goofy cycle. Just take one guy and replace him with another guy, and you think the problem's going to be solved? This problem has been around over 10,000 years, and these two solutions have been offered to us repetitively over the last 10,000 years. And why do people keep accepting these two possibilities as the only possibilities for a solution? Either make government bigger or hire a different clown to wear the crown. Neither of these two solutions have ever worked. Why would we think they would work now? You have to look beyond that. You have to look beyond the two solutions that the state is offering you. Involvement in government, getting in there, making a difference, has never worked. You just become polluted by the same thing that the last guy got polluted by. The process itself is illogical. The idea that the government can be an arbitrator of conflict when the government is the creator of conflict. The whole series of foundations that the government is based on fall apart, each and every one of them, as you examine it. What are we stuck with? What can we do? Well, keep in mind, think of the last 11 years. Think of all of the advances of the police state in the last 11 years. You think of all the advances in tyranny that we have watched take place. And at the same time, we're seeing a rise in the demand for liberty. We're seeing people who never used to talk about things like what I'm talking about in this podcast. We used to never see these things being spoken of openly. Very few people. There was the Murray Rothbard, and there was the, you know, this or that radical here or there that was saying these things. But now they're everywhere. Now people are saying it all over the internet. People are saying it on television shows. Liberty is rising. Liberty is increasing. The demand for liberty is increasing. And why is that happening? Because of Magic Ron Paul? We just need to put him in charge of the government? No. Back up. Think about it. That's one of the two-state solutions. As tyranny increases, the demand for liberty increases. I've talked before about air. Think about air. I was talking about property earlier, and I mentioned that scarcity was one of the aspects of property. So when you think of scarcity, when you think of air, you know, we don't think of air at all when we breathe. We just go around thinking we just breathe and we don't think about it until something happens to make that air scarce. Someone's choking us, or we're suddenly find ourselves in a room with no air. And all of a sudden, air becomes really, real, really important. Something we've never thought about in our life suddenly becomes the only thing we can think about. And you become desperate to try to find a way to get air. That's the same way with liberty. You know, when you're just, if you just have a guy and he's walking around doing this and doing that, and he's not really thinking about anything, he doesn't think about liberty. But it's only through oppression, it's only through tyranny that we recognize the need for liberty. So I've said this many, many times, when the market demands liberty, when there is a demand in the market for liberty, the market will provide liberty. And how is there going to be a demand for liberty? Well, we're watching it happen. As the state increases, as government gets stronger and stronger, and as government fails to provide the basic things that it claims to be able to provide, and when government continues to distort things and continues to pervert things like law and justice, as it does these things, there will be a greater and a greater demand within the market for liberty. And the only thing, really, the only weapon that is powerful enough to defeat government and defeat the mythology of the state and to bring this beast down, the only thing that's strong enough is the market. The market can't be stopped. And when the market demands liberty, when there is a demand in the market for liberty, the government will not be able to stop it. But the flip side of that is that market demand will be created when the tyranny of the government is most obvious. Folks, for more on liberty, the Zero Aggression Principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening today. Goodbye.